welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
Ah, yes. This evokes the origins of humanity to me. Today's first report comes from the Associated Press. Astronomer Sun Kwok, presenting a paper at the National Meeting of the American Astronomical Society, has suggested that the complex organic molecules that gave rise to life on Earth are being generated constantly in space. Kwok of the University of Calgary, Canada, said a study by the Infrared Space Observatory, which is operated by the European Space Agency, showed that large organic molecules evolve only within a few thousand years from chemicals in the cloud-like envelope surrounding some stars. Kwok and colleagues based their conclusion on the infrared spectra readings of short-lived carbon-rich stars that are engulfed in clouds of dust and gas. Kwok said these clouds are rich in some of the most advanced organic molecules ever detected in outer space. Such chemicals would eventually be ejected into interstellar space, he said, which makes it possible that they would end up on planets such as Earth, where under the right conditions, life would have evolved. Another international team has made calculations that suggest that life could have arisen on Mars and then been transferred to Earth by meteorites jolted away from the surface of Mars by asteroid impacts. A team of astronomers from 9 institutions and 5 countries made a serious study of the possibility and found that if life ever existed on Mars, then there could have been up to 5 trillion life-bearing rocks from Mars that landed on Earth over the last 4 billion years. The question, says Mari Valtonen of the Turku Observatory in Turku, Finland, the question is, are we really Martians? The international team also studied the possibility of life carrying asteroids from solar systems beyond the sun landing on the Earth and found the probability of this to be very low. The ancestral cell for life must have originated somewhere in our own solar system, said Kurt Miljukowski, an astronomer of the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden, and a leader of the research team. In their calculations, the astronomers considered how frequently Mars would have been hit by asteroids that blasted rock away from the red planet and sent it flying toward Earth. Although a few asteroids from Mars have been found on Earth, the team calculated that tons of Martian rock is here. The team also calculated the pressure, temperature, acceleration, and radiation a microbe would have had to endure to survive such a journey from Mars to Earth. At least 2 well-known microbes, Deinococcus radiodurans and Bacillus subtilis, said Miljukowski, could be capable of surviving the trip. He said the microbes have been tested in laboratories and found to be highly resistant to heat, radiation, and acceleration forces. Miljukowski said the microbe would have to be near the core of a Mars rock to be protected enough to survive the journey through the vacuum of space and endure the searing fall to Earth. If the size of the rock is more than a football, he said, heat would not have had time to get inside. The astronomers estimated that up to 1.5% of the microbes in such a rock would survive. So, we're Martians, folks. Likely, we're Martians. So, shortly after that, some couple billion years later, we became gendered microbes. And this is about that. Bruce Land of the University of Chicago and Dr. David Page of the Whitehead Institute report that they have traced the mutation history of the X and Y chromosomes to a single chromosome that started changing long before humans came along. In other words, the differences between men and women may have started some 240 to 320 million years ago, when an ordinary chromosome took the first evolutionary step from the X and Y chromosomes. Towards the X and Y chromosomes. The farther back in time we look, the more similar X and Y appear, boosting the theory that they arose from a pair of identical autosomes. An autosome is a non-sex-determining chromosome. A mammalian child's sex is determined by whether the successful sperm carries an X or Y chromosome to join with the egg's X chromosome. In many cold-blooded reptiles, which preceded mammals in evolutionary history, sex of the offspring is determined by the egg incubation temperature. This won't work for warm-blooded mammals, however, since we maintain a constant body temperature. Lan and Page found an early mammal mutation, somehow created a gene called SRY for sex-determining region Y, and it became the master switch for creating a male. Over evolutionary time, the male-determining Y chromosome became simpler and shared fewer and fewer genes with the more complex X. The Y has now only about a tenth of the genes that are present in the X chromosome. So, for Mother's Day, congratulate the slowly evolving X and Y chromosomes. And now, the May 2nd New York Times reports on the further evolution of the sex and gender. Quoting Nicholas Wade, the book of Genesis mentions three of Adam and Eve's children, Cain, Abel, and Seth. But geneticists, by tracing the DNA patterns found in people throughout the world, have now identified lineages descended from 10 sons of genetic Adam and 11 daughters of Eve. Delvers in the DNA archive have recently found evidence for a prehistoric human migration from Western Asia to North America, and identified people who seem closest to the ancestral human population and given substantial weight to the whispers long dismissed by historians that Thomas Jefferson fathered a family with his slave Sally Hemings. A new history of Britain and Ireland by Norman Davies, The Isles, begins with an account of Cheddar Man, a 9,000-year-old skeleton from which mitochondrial DNA was recently extracted. The DNA turned out to match that of Adrian Target, a teacher in the Cheddar Village School, proving a genetic continuity that, despite numerous invasions, had endured nine millenniums. The most detailed human family tree so far available is one constructed over many years by Dr. Douglas C. Wallace and his colleagues at the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. Dr. Wallace's tree is based on mitochondrial DNA, tiny rings of genetic material that are bequeathed only by the egg cell and thus through the maternal line. A counterpart tree for men, based on the analysis of the Y chromosome, has been prepared by Dr. Peter Underhill and Ofner of Stanford University. Population geneticists believe that the ancestral human population was very small, a mere 2,000 breeding individuals, according to a calculation published last December. But the family tree, based on human mitochondrial DNA, does not trace back to 1,000 women in this ancestral population. The tree is rooted in a single individual, the mitochondrial Eve, because all the other lineages fell extinct. The same is true of the Y chromosome tree, a consequence of the fact that in each generation, some men will have no children or only daughters, so the number of different Y chromosomes may steadily diminish, even if the population stays the same. This ancestral human population lived somewhere in Africa, geneticists believe, and started to split up sometime after 144,000 years ago, give or take 10,000 years, the inferred time at which both the mitochondrial and Y chromosome trees make their first branches. Mitochondria, which live inside human cells but outside the nucleus, escape the shuffling of genes that occurs between generations and are passed unchanged from mother to their children. In principle, all people should have the same string of DNA letters in their mitochondria. In practice, mitochondrial DNA has steadily accumulated changes over the centuries because of copying errors and radiation damage. Because women were steadily spreading across the globe when many of these changes occurred, some changes are found only in particular regions and continents. Dr. Wallace discovered that almost all American Indians have mitochondria that belong to lineages that he has named A, B, C, and D. Europeans belong to a different set of lineages, which he designated H through K and T through X. The split between the two main branches of the European tree suggests that modern humans reached Europe 39,000 to 51,000 years ago. In Asia, there is an ancestral lineage known as M, with descendant branches E, F, and G, as well as the A through D lineages that are also found in Americas. In Africa, there is a single male lineage, main lineage known as L, which is divided into three branches. L3, the youngest branch, is common in East Africa and is believed to be the source of both the Asian and European lineages. Dr. Wallace's mitochondrial DNA lineages are known technically as haplogroups, but more colloquially as daughters of Eve, because they are all branches of the trunk that stems from this mitochondrial Eve. The Y chromosome tree has not yet been published by the Stanford researchers, but in a book that came out in March, Genes, People, and Languages, a colleague at the university, Dr. Luca Cavalli-Sforza, sketched a preview of the findings. The tree, the male tree, is rooted in a single Y chromosomal atom and has 10 principal branches. Of these sons of Adam, the first three are found almost exclusively in Africa. Son 3's lineage migrated to Asia and begat sons 4 through 10, who spread through the rest of the world to the Sea of Japan, son 9, son 4, Northern India, son 5, and the South Caspian Seas, sons 6 through 9. In an article published in March in the American Journal of Human Genetics, Wallace and colleagues identify the Vasikela Kung of the northwestern Kalahari Desert in southern Africa as the population that lies nearest to the root of the human mitochondrial DNA tree. Another population that seems almost equally old is that of the Bayaka pygmies of Central Africa. In 1988, Dr. Wallace and his colleagues discovered in North America the X pattern, a rare European lineage among the Northern Native Americans, such as the Ojibwa and the Sioux. At first, they assumed it had come from intermarriage with modern Europeans, but the American X lineage turned out to be pre-Columbian, and its owners would have had to have arrived in America either 15,000 or 30,000 years ago, depending on certain genetic assumptions. I'll return to the European migration in a minute. Last month, a company called Oxford Ancestors set up business with the offer to tell customers which of the seven daughters of Eve they're descended from. Almost all Europeans belong to only seven of the nine mitochondrial lineages found in Europe. The test, see www.oxfordancestors.com, requires sending in a sample of cells brushed from the inside of your cheek. For a mere $180, anyone of European ancestry can establish the start of a lineage far senior to Charlemagne's. This is all from the New York Times, by the way. The company's founder is Dr. Brian Sykes, a human geneticist at the University of Oxford in England. On the reasonable basis that the founders of Dr. Wallace's mitochondrial DNA lineages were real women, Dr. Sykes gave them names. He named them Ursula, Xenia, Tara, Helena, Katrine, Valda, and Jasmine, and sketched in details of their likely dates and origin. Thus, people found to belong to the haplogroup U will be told they are descended from Ursula, who lived about 45,000 years ago in northern Greece. Ancestor of the X's is Xenia, who lived 25,000 years ago in the Caucasus Mountains. As if fulfilling Dr. Wilson's suggestion, Dr. Sykes said that he had worked out a mythological framework for these seven women in respect of the arduous times in which they must have lived and the triumph of spreading their mitochondrial DNA to almost all the inhabitants of Europe. He's now working on tests to identify other lineages around the world, including the 14 in Africa, the 16 in Eurasia, and the Americas. "I don't think this stuff should be confined to the academics," he said. Now, you're listening to Dr. J on Change Life Radio. Today we're talking about human origins, and it's turning out to be kind of a Mother's Day discussion. Central to the debate over the origins of the first human settlements in North America has been the genetic testing of the corpse of the 9,300-year-old Kennewick man, discovered in 1996 in Washington State. Morphological examination suggested that Kennewick man was closer to Europeans than the Asiatic features of the north of the Native Americans. But the Native tribes local to Washington State invoked federal laws granting possession of all historical bones to the local Native tribes and insisted that the bones be buried and not studied. The theory being that all contemporary Native Americans are descendants of these ancient bodies, which of course is exactly what was in question with Kennewick man. Anthropologists filed suit to study the body, and they were joined by the Asatru Folk Assembly, a leading religious organization devoted to the ancient Norse gods, Odin, Zeus, and so on. That is, and they believe that this ancient Scandinavian explorer of the ancient Americas would have presumably worshipped their same gods. I interviewed Steve McNallan, the high priest of the Asatru, a year and a half ago about the Kennewick suit. Since then, a federal judge and the National Park Service have granted permission to a scientific group to take the body for testing, and a full genetic analysis will soon be released. At a controversial press conference recently at the meetings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, however, another twist was added to the story. Loring Brace, a specialist in bone measurements at the University of Michigan, is contending that Europeans, the Kennewick man, and European-like groups such as the Japanese Ainu, are the result of mixed marriage with Neanderthals. Quoting from a report in Reuters, "It is a controversial theory because most scientists believe that Neanderthals were an evolutionary dead end, people who lived side by side with the Cro-Magnons, but who the earliest Homo sapiens, but who did not interbreed with them. But Loring said his measurements that compare the skulls of people all over the world suggest a resemblance among peoples living in Europe, along the coastlines of Asia, and into ancient North America. He also found two distinct groups among the Native Americans. It's clear that there are two major groups, and they are not closely related to each other at all. One group physically resembles East Asians, especially modern Chinese, while the second looks a lot like the Ainu. Some of the Plains Indians don't look Native American at all," he said. He thinks they may have come from the same lineage as the Kennewick man. Brace had not been allowed to examine the Kennewick remains, but thinks any measurements he could make would support his theories. Some recent evidence tends to support his idea. In October, an international team tested Neanderthal bones found in Croatia in the 1970s and found that they may be just 28,000 years old, which means that they would have lived side by side with modern humans for several thousand years. Eric Trinkus, an anthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis, led that study, and another one that a few months later suggested that 25,000-year-old bones of a child found in Portugal showed characteristics of both Neanderthals and modern humans. Trinkus said that he believed this suggested humans and Neanderthals interbred, but Brace said it is just as easily could have been an intermediate form of human evolving from Neanderthal into modern Homo sapiens. Although just a few years ago everyone agreed no humans lived in the New World until about 11,000 years ago, and that everyone trekked together over the Bering Strait into Alaska, more and more evidence suggests that people started coming over in successive waves as long as 30,000 years ago. David Meltzer, an anthropologist at Southern Methodist University, noted that huge ice sheets would have blocked any passage from the Bering Strait down through Canada until 11,500 years ago. A settlement in Monteverde, Chile, has been dated to 12,500 years ago, which suggests that people must have come either a different way or long before the ice sheets formed. Theodore Schur of the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research in San Antonio did genetic studies that found four separate lineages in the Americas, and using a genetic molecular clock that tracks the rate of mutations in DNA, dates some of them back as far as 25,000 to 30,000 years ago. Some seem to originate in southeastern Siberia, while one seems to have links with the relatively rare lineage found in a few modern Europeans, which I just referred to, the Lineage X. For more information about the Kennewick Man, go to the Kennewick Man Virtual Interpretation Center. It's at www.kennewick, which is kennewick-man.com. And for a truly mind-blowing meditation on human evolution, past and future, I recommend Greg Bear's recent novel, Darwin's Radio. It explores the theory that the so-called junk DNA in the human chromosome, long stretches of DNA that don't apparently code for anything, may in fact encode a repertoire of potentially adaptive responses to environmental triggers and signals. Given sufficiently powerful environmental pressures, the mechanism might unleash a series of experimental mutations designed to adapt the species to their conditions. Bear's novel sketches out a very powerful version of this theory. Not powerful in the sense that it's convincing, but powerful in that the mechanism is proposed to be astonishingly powerful, which would answer some apparent gaps in the evolutionary record. The pattern of long stretches of continuity interrupted by brief and dramatic change has been called punctuated equilibrium. The assumption of most punctuated equilibrists is that when an environmental change wipes out 99% of a species, that the genetic differences of the survivors, correlated with the reasons for their survival, explain the dramatic changes. But some of the changes are more dramatic than that. In Bear's novel, the junk DNA actually creates an entirely new genome, resulting in children that are dramatically different from their parents. His novel occurs in parallel stories in ancient Europe, following Neanderthals who are giving birth to human babies, and in the near future, with humans giving birth to post-humans. That's Darwin's Radio by Greg Baer. Highly recommended. And switching gears from our evolution up to this point to a potential future, there's been quite a flutter in the media over the last 6 weeks since Bill Joy, the chief scientist at Sun Microsystems, published in April's Wired magazine a reflection on the threats posed by technology. His article was titled, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. Uncharacteristically dark for a top scientist attached to a multinational corporation, Joy warned that runaway nanotechnology, robotics, and genetic engineering had the potential to end civilization before we have a chance to harness its benefits. He called for scientists to exercise restraint and for an international moratoria on certain kinds of technology. Of course, the change surfers already know about the threat posed by gray goo. Quoting Bill Joy, most dangerously, for the first time, these accidents and abuses are widely within the reach of individuals or small groups, he writes. They will not require large facilities or rare raw materials. Knowledge alone will enable the use of them. Joy has played a leading role in developing Unix and Java, and he helped found Sun Microsystems. He's also served as co-chairman of a presidential committee on the future of information technology. Joy argues that while previous dangerous technologies were tightly controlled by the military, future dangerous technologies will be implemented by competitive corporations with few concerns beyond profit. And here he's mainly contrasting nuclear weapons with the threats that he's talking about. Joy says that the key difference between previous technologies and our current technologies is self-replication. Whilst replication in a computer or a computer network can be a nuisance, he writes, uncontrolled self-replication in these newer technologies runs a much greater risk, a risk of substantial damage in the physical world. Joy points to three sources of concern in particular: self-replicating superintelligent machines that could compete with humans, genetically engineered diseases targeted at specific populations, and gray goo, a self-replicating set of nanorobots which could spread out of control and have catastrophic effects. Joy insists that he is not a Luddite, and yet he also argues that the issues raised by the convicted bomber, Ted Kaczynski, have not been adequately addressed by the nation's technologists. Kaczynski's actions were murderous and, in my view, criminally insane, he writes. But simply saying this does not dismiss his argument. As difficult as it is for me to acknowledge, I saw some merit in the reasoning. His article is quite chilling, actually. I recommend that you go to Wired.com, www.wired.com. Kind of ironic, actually, that Wired would run it, but given who he was and the importance of what he's saying, I guess they couldn't see any way around it. But www.wired.com and look for Bill Joy, his article on why the future does not need humanity. I thought I'd include here some quotes from various people. If you're one of those folks who listens to the show and finds it amusing and kind of science fictional, but doesn't think that a lot of the things that I talk about on the show actually will come to pass, the kinds of technologies are too far in the future to actually be serious, I just wanted to read you some of these quotes of folks who have said similar things in the past. Drill for oil? You mean drill into the ground to try and find oil? You're crazy. That's workers to railroad conductor Edwin Drake before he drilled the first successful U.S. oil in 1859. Well-informed people know it is impossible to transmit the voice over wires, and that were it possible to do so, the thing would be of no practical value. Boston Post, 1865. Everything that can be invented has been invented, says Charles Duell, director of the U.S. Patent Office, 1899. Heavier-than-air flying machines are impossible, Lord Kelvin of the British Royal Society, one of the 19th century's top experts in thermodynamics. The world is coming to an end in 1950, historian Henry Adams writing in 1903. There is no likelihood that man can ever tap the power of the atom, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Robert Millikan in 1923. Who the heck wants to hear actors talk? H.M. Warner of Warner Brothers in 1927. A rocket will never be able to leave Earth's atmosphere, New York Times, 1936. I think there is a world market for maybe five computers, says IBM's Thomas Watson, 1943. Television won't last because people will soon get tired of staring at a plywood box every night. Producer Daryl Zanuck, 20th Century Fox, 1946. If excessive smoking actually plays a role in the production of lung cancer, it seems to be a minor one. That was the director of the National Cancer Institute in 1954. You ain't going nowhere, son. You ought to go back to driving a truck. That's the Grand Ole Opry's Jim Denny to Elvis Presley in 1954. By 2000, politics will simply fade away. We'll not see any political parties by then. Visionary and inventor R. Buckminster Fuller, 1966. Well, he was right about a lot of other things. There's no need for an individual to have a computer in their home. Ken Olson, president of Digital Equipment Corporation, that's DEC, 1977. And here's the final one. Microsoft Bill Gates, writing in 1981. 640K ought to be enough for anybody. Of course, he contributed to the need for all the rest of that K. You've been listening to Jay Hughes, Dr. J, on Change Surfer Radio.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.